into a dining room that had been converted into office space. Apparently, she did some kind of wedding consulting. I could see bridal magazines stacked everywhere. A bulletin board that hung above the desk was covered with photographs, sample invitations, illustrations of wedding bouquets, and articles about honeymoon cruises. A schedule with 15 to 20 names and dates indicated upcoming nuptials that she needed to keep abreast of. The carpeting was white shag, the couch and chairs upholstered in steel blue canvas, with throw pillows in off-white and seafoam green. Aside from a cluster of family photographs in antique silver frames, there were no knick-knacks. The room was interspersed with a variety of glossy houseplants, big healthy specimens that seemed to saturate the air with oxygen. This was fortunate, given all the noxious cigarette smoke in the air. The furnishings were handsome, probably inexpensive knockoffs of designer brands. Dana Jaffe was pencil-thin, wearing tight, faded jeans and a plain white T-shirt, tennis shoes without socks. When I wear the same outfit, it looks like I'm all set to change the oil in my car. On her, the outfit had a careless elegance. She had her hair pulled into a knot at the nape of her neck, tied with a scarf. I could see now that the blonde was laced with silver, but the effect was artless, as if she were confident the aging process could only add interest to a face already honed and chiseled. The overbite made her mouth seem pouty, and probably kept her from being labeled beautiful, whatever that consists of. She would be relegated to categories like interesting or attractive, though personally I'd have killed for a face like hers, strong and arresting, with a flawless complexion. She picked up the cigarette she'd left in the ashtray, dragging on it deeply as she went on with her conversation. "I don't think you'll be happy with that," she was saying. "Well, the style's not going to be flattering. You told me Corey's cousin was on the hefty side." "Okay, a blimp. A blimp. A blimp. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You don't want to put a peplum on a blimp." "A full skirt." "Uh-huh, right. That's going to minimize heavy legs and hips." "No, no, no. I'm not talking about bulky fullness. I understand. But something with a slightly dropped waist. I think we should find a dress with a shaped neckline, too, because that's going to pull the eye upward. Do you understand what I'm saying?" "Well, why don't I go through my books here, and I'll come up with some suggestions. You might have Corey pick up a couple of brides' magazines from the supermarket." "We can talk tomorrow." "Okay. All right, fine. I'll call you back." "You're entirely welcome." "You too." She replaced the receiver and gave the telephone cord a little looping flap, pulling the length of it toward her. She extinguished the cigarette in an ashtray on her desk and then moved into the living room, smoke still trailing from her mouth. I took a quick moment to scan the room. In the small slice of family room that I could see, there were miscellaneous items of baby paraphernalia. A playpen, a high chair, a wind-up swing guaranteed to put an infant to sleep if it didn't generate a lot of puking first. "You'd never guess I'm a grandma," she said with irony when she caught my eye. I had placed my business card on the coffee table, and I saw her glance at it again with curiosity. I tucked in a hasty question before she had a chance to quiz me. "Are you moving? I saw the boxes on the porch. It looks like you're all set." "Not me. My son and his wife. They've just bought a little house." She leaned over and picked up the card. "Excuse me. I'd like to know what this is about. If it has to do with Brian, you'll need to talk to his attorney. I'm not at liberty to discuss his situation." "This is not about Brian. It's about Wendell." Her gaze became fixed. "Have a seat," she said, indicating a nearby chair. She sat down on the edge of the couch, pulling an ashtray in closer to her. She lit another cigarette, her movements brisk, dragging deeply as she arranged both her lighter and the pack of Eve 100s on the table in front of her. "Were you acquainted with him?" "Not at all," I said. I perched on a chrome and gray leather director's chair that squawked beneath my weight. Sounded like I'd made a rude butt noise as a joke. She blew two streams of smoke from her nose. "Because he's dead, you know. He's been gone for years. He got into trouble and he killed himself. That's why I'm here. Last week, the California Fidelity agent who sold Wendell his life insurance policy... Dick, what's his name? Mills. That's correct. Mr. Mills was vacationing in a little Mexican resort, and spotted Wendell in a bar. She burst out laughing.
Oh, sure, right.
I stirred uncomfortably. It's true. She cut the power on the smile by half.
Don't be silly. What are we talking here, a seance or something? Wendell's dead, my dear.
As I understand it, Dick Mills did quite a bit of business with him. I gather he knew Wendell well enough to make the initial ID. I'm handling the follow-up. She continued to smile, but it was all form and no content. She blinked at me with interest.
He actually talked to him? You'll have to forgive my skepticism, but I'm having a problem with this. The two of them had a conversation?
I shook my head. Dick was on his way to the airport at the time, and he didn't want Wendell to catch sight of him. As soon as he got home, he called one of the CF vice presidents, who turned around and hired me to fly down there. At this point, the identification isn't positive, but the chances are good. It looks like he's not only alive, but headed back to the area.
I don't believe it. There's been some mistake.
Her tone was emphatic, but her expression suggested she was waiting for the punchline, a half-smile flickering. I wondered how many times she'd played the scene in her head. Some police detective or an FBI agent sitting in her living room, giving her the news that Wendell was alive and well, or that his body had finally been recovered. She'd probably lost track of what she wanted to hear. I could see her struggle with a number of conflicting attitudes, most of which were bad. Agitated, she took a drag of her cigarette and then blew out a mouthful of smoke, her mouth curling up in a parody of mirth as she tried on a new reaction.
Let me hazard a guess here. I'll bet there's money involved. A little payoff, is that it?
Why would I do that? I asked.
What's the point, then? Why tell me about it? I couldn't care less.
I was hoping you'd let me know if Wendell tries to get in touch.
You think Wendell would try to get in touch with me? This is dumb. Don't be ridiculous.
I don't know what to tell you, Mrs. Jaffe. I can understand how you feel.
What are you talking about? The man is dead. Don't you get it? He turned out to be a con artist, a common crook. I've had trouble enough dealing with all the people he cheated. You're not going to turn around now and tell me he's still out there, she snapped.
We think he faked his own death, probably to avoid prosecution for fraud and grand theft. I reached for my handbag. I have a picture if you want to see him. This was done by a police artist. It's not exact, but it's close. I saw him myself. I pulled out the photocopy of the picture, unfolded the paper, and passed it over to her. She studied it with an intensity that was almost embarrassing.
This isn't Wendell. This looks nothing like him.
She tossed it back toward the table. The paper sailed off the edge like an airplane taking off.
I thought they did these with computers. What's the matter? Are the cops here too cheap?
She snatched up my business card again and read my name. I could see that her hand had begun to shake.
Look, Ms. Milhone, maybe I should explain something. Wendell put me through hell. Whether he's dead or alive is immaterial from my perspective. You want to know why?
I could see she was working herself into a snit. I understand you had him declared dead, I ventured.
That's right. You got it. Very good, she said. I've collected his life insurance. That's how dead he is. This is over and done. Finito, you savvy? I'm getting on with my life. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not interested in Wendell one way or the other. I've got other problems. I've got other problems I'm coping with at the moment, and as far as I'm concerned...
The telephone began to ring, and she glanced back with annoyance.
The machine will pick up.
The machine clicked in, and Dana intoned the standard advice about a name, telephone number, and a message. Without even thinking about it, we both turned to listen.
Please wait for the beep.
Dana's recorded voice admonished. We paused dutifully, waiting for the beep. I could hear a woman using the artificial message-giving voice that machines inspire.
Hello, Dana. This is Miriam Salazar. Your name was given to me by Judith Prancer as a bridal consultant. My daughter Angela is getting married next April, and I just thought we should have a preliminary conversation. I'd appreciate a call back. Thanks.
She left her telephone number. Dana smoothed her hair back, checking the scarf at the nape of her neck.
Jesus, this has been a crazy summer, she commented idly. I've had 2 and 3 weddings every weekend. Plus, I'm getting ready for a midsummer bridal fair.
I stared at her, saying nothing. Like many people, she was capable of delivering informational asides while in the midst of a highly charged emotional conversation. I hardly knew where to take the matter next. Wait until she figured out that California Fidelity was going to reclaim the insurance money if Wendell showed up in the flesh? I shouldn't even have allowed the thought to enter my head, because the minute it occurred to me, she seemed to read my mind.
Oh, wait. Don't tell me. I just collected $500,000. I hope the insurance company doesn't think I'm going to give the money back.
You'd have to talk to them about that. Generally, they don't pay death benefits if a guy's not really dead. They're kind of cranky that way.
Now, just a goddamn minute. If he's alive, which I'm not buying for a minute, but if it turned out he was, it's hardly my responsibility.
Well, it certainly isn't theirs.
I've waited years for that money. I'd be dead broke without it. You don't understand the kind of struggle I've been through. I've had 2 boys to raise with no help from anyone.
You'd probably be smart to talk to an attorney, I said.
An attorney? What for? I didn't do anything. I've suffered enough because of Wendell goddamn Jaffe, and if you think for 1 minute I'm giving that money back, you're crazy. You want to collect, you'll have to get it from him.
Mrs. Jaffe, I don't make policy decisions for California Fidelity. All I do is investigate and file reports. I have no control over what they do.
I didn't cheat, she cut in.
No one's accusing you of cheating. She cupped a hand around her ear.
Yet, she said. Don't I hear a big fat yet at the end of that sentence?
What you hear me saying is take it up with them. I'm only here because I thought you should be aware of what's going on. If Wendell tries to get in touch...
Jesus, would you stop that? What earthly reason would he have to get in touch with me?
Because he probably read about Brian's escapades in all the Mexican papers. That shut her up momentarily. She stared at me with the panicky blank look of a woman with a train bearing down the track at her and a car that won't start. Her voice dropped.
I can't deal with this. I'm sorry, but this is all nonsense as far as I'm concerned. I'll have to ask you to leave.
She rose to her feet, and I rose at the same time.
Hey, Mom?
Dana jumped. Her oldest son, Michael, was coming down the stairs. He caught sight of us and paused.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know you were busy down here.
He was lanky and slim, with a dark mop of silky hair much in need of a cut. His face was narrow, nearly pretty, with large dark eyes and long lashes. He wore jeans, a sweatshirt emblazoned with a fake college decal, and high-top tennis shoes. Dana flashed a bright smile at him to disguise her distress.
We're just finishing. What is it, baby? Did you guys want something to eat?
I thought I'd make a run. Juliet's out of cigarettes, and the baby needs Pampers. I just wondered if you needed anything.
Actually, you might pick up some milk for breakfast. We're almost out, she replied.
Get a 1/2 gallon of low-fat and 1/4 of orange juice, if you would. There's some honey on the kitchen table. 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 Honey on the kitchen...
I got some, he said.
You keep that, honey. I'll get it.
She moved off toward the kitchen. Michael continued to the bottom of the steps and snagged his jacket from the newel post where it was draped. He nodded at me shyly, perhaps mistaking me for one of his mother's bridal clients. Despite the fact that I'd been married twice, I've never had a formal wedding. The closest I'd ever come was a Bride of Frankenstein outfit one Halloween when I was in the 2nd grade. I had fangs and fake blood, and my aunt drew clumsy black stitches up and down my face. My bridal veil was affixed to my head with numerous bobby pins, most of which I'd lost by the time the evening came to an end. The dress itself was a cut-down version of a ballerina costume, some kind of Swan Lake number with an ankle-length skirt. My aunt had added sparkles, making squiggles with a tube of Elmer's glue that she sprinkled with dime-store glitter. I'd never felt so glamorous. I remember looking at myself solemnly in the mirror that night in a halo of netting, thinking it was probably the most beautiful dress I would ever own. Sure enough, I've never had anything quite like it since, though in truth, it's not the dress so much as the feeling I miss. Dana came back into the living room and pressed a 20 into Michael's hand. They had a brief chat about the errand. While I waited for them to finish their business, I picked up one of the silver-framed photos. It looked like Wendell in high school, which is to say, dorky-looking with a bad haircut. Michael left for the store, and Dana moved over to the table where I was standing. She took the picture from my hand and set it back on the tabletop. I said, "Is that Wendell in high school?" She nodded, distracted.
"Cottonwood Academy, which has gone out of business since. His was the last class to graduate. I gave his class ring to Michael. I'll give Brian his college ring when the time comes."
"When what time comes?"
"Oh, some special occasion. I tell them it's something their father and I always talked about."
"That's laying it on a bit thick, isn't it?" Dana shrugged.
"Just because I think Wendell's a schmuck doesn't mean they have to. I want them to have a man to look up to, even if he isn't real. They need a role model."
"So you gave them an idealized version?"
"It might be a mistake, but what else can I do?" she said, coloring.
"Yeah, really. Especially when he pulls a deal like this."
"I know I've given him more credit than he deserves, but I don't want to badmouth the man to his sons."
"I understand the impulse. I'd probably do the same in your place," I said. She reached out impulsively and touched my arm.
"Please leave us alone. I don't know what's going on, but I don't want them brought into it."
"I won't bother you if I can.
Won't help it.
But you're still going to have to tell them."
"Why?"
"Because Wendell could beat you to it, and you might not like the effect."
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 8.
It was nearly 10 p.m. by the time I hoofed it through the strip lot behind the Santa Teresa Yacht Club. After I left Dana Jaffe, I hit the 101 North, tearing back up the coast to my apartment, where I hastily tried on several hangers' worth of hand-me-downs Vera'd passed along to me. In her unbiased opinion, I'm a complete fashion nerd, and she's trying to teach me the rudiments of chic. Vera's into these Annie Hall ensembles that look like you're preparing for a life sleeping on sewer grates. Jackets over vests over tunics over pants. The only thing I lack is a grocery cart for the rest of my possessions. I sorted through the garments, wondering which items were supposed to go with which. I need a personal trainer when it comes to this shit, someone to explain the underlying strategy. Since Vera is 20 pounds heavier and a good 5 inches taller, I bypassed the slacks, imagining I'd look like Droopy of the Seven Dwarves. She'd given me 2 long skirts with elasticized waists, swearing either would look great with my black leather boots. There was also a 40s-looking rayon drop-waist print dress with an ankle-length skirt. I pulled the garment over my head and regarded myself in the mirror. I'd seen Vera wear this, and she'd looked like a vamp. I looked like I was 6, playing dress-up in the discards from my aunt's rag bag. I went back to one of the long skirts, a black washable silk. I think she intended for me to hem the length, but I simply rolled it up at the waist, a little donut effect. She'd also given me a tunic top in a color she called taupe, a blend of gray and old cigar butts, with a long white vest that went over both. She told me I could dress up the outfit with accessories. Big duh. Like I really had some kind of clue how to make that work. I searched my drawers for jewelry, to no avail, and finally decided to wear the long crocheted runner my aunt had made for the dresser top. I gave it a little flap to get all the woofies out, and then looped it around my neck with the ends hanging down the front. Looked good to me. Kind of devil-may-care, like Isadora Duncan or Amelia Earhart. The yacht club sits on stilts overlooking the beach, with the harbor master's office nearby and the long concrete arm of the breakwater curving out to the left. The sound of the surf was thunderous that night, like the rumble of cars moving over wooden trestles. The ocean was oddly agitated, the far-flung effects from some violent weather pattern that would probably never reach us. A dense haze hung in the air like a scrim through which I caught shadowy glimpses of the moon-tinted horizon. The sand glowed white, and the boulders piled up around the foundations of the building were draped with strands of kelp. Even from the sidewalk down below, I could hear the trumpeting laughter of the heavy drinkers. I climbed the wide wooden steps to the entrance and in through the glass doors. A second set of stairs ascended to the right, and I made my way up toward the smoke and recorded music in the bar above. The room was L-shaped,
diners occupying the long arm, drinkers confined to the short, which was just as well. The noise level was oppressive, given the fact that most of the dinner crowd had departed, and the bar was only half filled. The floor was carpeted, the entire upper story wrapped in windows that overlooked the Pacific. By day, club members were treated to panoramic ocean views. At night, the black glass threw back smudged reflections, pointing up the need for the rigorous application of Windex. When I reached the maitre d's pulpit, I paused, watching him approach me from across the room. "Yes, ma'am," he said. I guessed he'd been recently promoted from his job as head waiter because he held his left arm at an angle, a ready rack for some wine towel he no longer had to tote. "I'm looking for Carl Eckert. Is he here tonight?" I saw his gaze flick downward, taking in my scruffy boots, the long skirt, the vest, shoulder bag, and my ill-cut hair, which the sea wind had tossed into mop-like perfection. "Is he expecting you?" His tone suggested he'd expect invading Martians first. I held out a discreetly folded $5 bill. "Now he is," I said. The fellow slipped the bill in his pocket without checking the denomination, which made me wish I had given him a single. He indicated a gentleman sitting at a window table by himself. I had plenty of time to study him as I crossed the room. I put him in his early 50s, still of an age where he'd be referred to as youthful. He was silver-haired and stocky. His once handsome face had gone soft now along the jawline, though the effect was still nice. While most of the men in the bar were dressed casually, Carl Eckert wore a conservative dark gray herringbone suit with a light gray shirt and navy wool tie with a grid of light gray. I wound my way among the tables, wondering what the hell I was going to say to him. He saw me headed in his direction and focused on me as I drew within range. "Carl?" He smiled at me politely.
"That's right."
"Kinsey Milhone, may I join you?" I held out my hand. He half rose from his chair and leaned forward courteously, shaking hands with me. His grip was aggressive, the skin on his palm icy cold from his drink.
"If you like," he said.
His eyes were blue and his gaze was unyielding. He gestured toward a chair. I placed my handbag on the floor and eased onto the seat adjacent to his. "I hope I'm not intruding."
"That depends on what you want."
His smile was pleasant but fleeting, and never really reached as far as his eyes. "It looks like Wendell Jaffe is alive." His expression shifted into neutral, and his body went still, animation suspended as if from a momentary power loss. For a split second it flashed on me that he might have been in touch with Wendell since his disappearance. He was apparently willing to take my word for it, which saved all the bullshit Dane had put me through. He assimilated the information, sparing me additional expressions of shock or surprise. There was no hint of denial or disbelief. He seemed to shift into gear again. He reached in his jacket pocket smoothly and took out a pack of cigarettes, his way of stalling until he could figure out what I was up to. He shook several cigarettes into view and held the pack out for my selection. I shook my head, refusing. He put a cigarette between his lips.
"Will it bother you if I smoke?"
"Not a bit. Go ahead." Actually, I abhor smoking, but I wanted some information, and I didn't think it was the time to voice my prejudice. He struck a paper match and cupped his hands around the flame. He gave the match a shake and dropped it in the ashtray, easing the pack of matches back into his pocket again. I smelled sulfur, and that first whiff of smoldering tobacco that to me smells like no other. Early mornings on the road, I catch the same scent drifting through the room vents in those hotels where the smokers aren't properly segregated from the rest of us.
"Would you like a drink?" he asked. "I'm about to order another round myself."
"I'd like that, thanks."
"What'll it be?"
"Chardonnay would be fine." He held his hand up for the waiter, who moved over to the table and took the order. Eckert was having scotch. Once the waiter disappeared, his attention came back to me, and he focused his gaze.
"Who are you? A cop? Narc? IRS what?"
"I'm a private detective working for California Fidelity on the life insurance claim."
"Dana just collected on it, didn't she?" 2 months ago.
A group of guys in the bar burst into sudden harsh laughter, and it forced Eckert to lean forward to make himself heard.
How did all this business come to light?
A retired CF insurance agent spotted him in Mexico last week. I was hired to fly down the next day to verify the report.
And you actually verified that it was Wendell?
More or less, I said. I never met Mr. Jaffe, so it'd be hard for me to swear it was him.
But you did see him, he said.
Or someone damn close. He's had surgery, of course. It's probably the first thing he did.
Carl stared at me blankly and then shook his head. A brief smile appeared.
I assume you've told Dana?
I just talked to her. She wasn't thrilled.
I should think not.
He seemed to search my face.
What's your name again?
I took out a business card and passed it across the table.
You know his kid was in trouble, I asked.
Behind us there was another burst of laughter, this one louder than the last. The guys were apparently having another tedious, bawdy joke fest.
He glanced at my name on the card and tucked it in his shirt pocket.
I read about Brian in the paper, he said. This is curious.
What is?
The notion of Wendell. I was just thinking about him. Since his body never surfaced, I guess I always had my doubts about his death. I never said much. I figured people would think I was unwilling to face the facts. In denial, they call it. Where has he been all this time?
I didn't have a chance to ask.
Is he still down there?
He checked out of the hotel in the dead of night, and that's the last I've seen of him. He may be on his way back.
Because of Brian, he said, instantly making the connection.
That's my guess. At any rate, it's the only lead we have. Not really a lead, but at least a place to start.
Why tell me?
In case he tries to make contact.
The waiter returned with our drinks, and Carl looked up.
Thanks, Jimmy. Put this on my tab, if you would.
He took the bill, tacked on a tip, and scrawled his name across the bottom before he handed it back.
The waiter murmured,
Thank you, Mr. Eckert. Will there be anything else? We're fine. You have a good night.
Carl nodded absent-mindedly, regarding me with speculation. I reached in my handbag and pulled a copy from the sheaf of composites Valbusa had done.
I have a picture if you want to see it.
I laid it on the table in front of him.
Carl stuck his cigarette in the corner of his mouth, squinting slightly from the smoke as he studied Wendell's face. He shook his head, his smile bitter.
What a fuck.
I thought you might be glad to hear he was alive, I said.
Hey, I went to jail because of him. A lot of people wanted a piece of my hide. When money goes down the toilet, someone has to take the blame. I didn't mind paying my debt, but I sure as hell hated paying his.
Must have been hard.
You have no idea. Once I filed bankruptcy, all the loans went into default. It was a mess. I don't want to get into that.
If Wendell gets in touch, will you let me know?
Probably, he said. I don't want to talk to him, that's for sure. He was a good friend. At least I thought he was.
There was another burst of laughter. He shifted restlessly and pushed his drink aside.
Let's go down to the boat. It's too fucking loud in here.
Without waiting for an answer, he got up and left the table. Startled, I grabbed my handbag and scurried after him. The noise level dropped dramatically the minute we stepped outside. The air was cold and fresh. The wind had picked up, and the waves crashed against the seawall in a series of blasting sprays. Boom! A feathery plume, like a stalk of pampas grass, would dance along the breakwater and go down again, throwing off a splat of water that landed on the walk as if it were being thrown by the bucket. When we reached the locked gate leading into Marina 1, he took out his card key and let us through. In a curiously gallant gesture, Carl put his hand on my elbow and guided me down the slippery wooden ramp. I could hear creaking sounds as the boats shifted in the harbor waters, bobbing and swaying with an occasional tinkling of metal on metal. Our footsteps formed an irregular rhythm as we clunked along the walkway. The four marinas provide slips for about 1,100 boats, protected from the open waters, in an 84-acre area. The wharf on one side is like the crook of a thumb, with the breakwater curling toward it in a nearly completed circle in which the boats are nestled.
In addition to visitors occupying temporary slips, there are usually a number of permanent liveaboards, using their boats as their primary residence. Key secured restrooms provide toilets and showers, with a holding tank pump-out station located on the south side of the fuel dock. At the J dock, we took a left, proceeding another 30 yards to the boat. The Captain Stanley Lord was a 35-foot Fuji Ketch, derived from a John Alden-designed sailing vessel with the mainmast toward the bow. The exterior was painted an intense dark green with the trim in navy blue. Carl pulled himself up on the narrow deck and then extended a hand, pulling me up after him. In the dark I could make out the mainsheet and the mizzenmast, but not much else. He unlocked the door and slid the hatch forward.
"Watch your head," he said as he moved down into the galley. "You know anything about boats?"
"Not much," I said. I eased carefully down four steep carpeted stairs into the galley behind him.
"This one has three headsails, a 150 Genoa, a 110 working jib, and a storm jib. Then the mainsail, of course, and the mizzen."
"Why is it called the Captain Stanley Lord? Who's he?"
"It's nautical lore. Wendell's sense of humor, such as it was. Stanley Lord was captain of the Californian, allegedly the only boat close enough to the Titanic to have helped with the rescue. Lord claimed he never picked up the distress signal, but a later investigation suggested he ignored the SOS. He was blamed for the extent of the disaster, and the scandal ruined his career. Wendell used the same name for the company, CSL Investments. I never did get it, but he thought it was amusing."
The interior had the cozy, unreal feeling of a doll's house, the kind of space I love best, compact and efficient, every square inch put to use. There was a diesel stove on my left, and on my right an assortment of seagoing equipment, radio, compass, a fire extinguisher, monitors for wind velocity and the electrical systems, the heater, main switch, and the engine start battery. I was picking up the faint smell of varnish, and I could see that one of the berth cushions still had a sales tag attached. All the upholstery was done in dark green canvas, with the seams piped in white.
"Nice," I said. He flushed with pleasure. "You like it?"
"It looks great," I said. I moved over to one of the berths and dropped my handbag, sitting down. I stretched my arm out along the cushion.
"Comfortable," I remarked.
"How long have you had it?"
"About a year," he said. "The IRS seized it shortly after Wendell disappeared. I was a guest of the feds for about 18 months. After that, I was broke. Once I got a little money ahead, I had to track down the guy who'd bought it from the government. I went through an incredible rigmarole before he'd agree to sell. Not that he had much use for it. It was a mess when he finally turned it over to me."
"I don't know why people have to be such butts." He peeled off his suit coat and loosened his tie so he could ease the button on his shirt collar.
"You want another white wine? I have some chilled."
"Half a glass," I said. He chatted about sailing for a while, and then I brought the subject back to Wendell. "Where'd they find the boat?" He opened a miniature refrigerator and took out a bottle of Chardonnay.
"Off the Baja coast. There are huge shifting sandbars about 6 miles out. It looked like the boat had run aground and drifted loose again with the tide."
He stripped the foil off the neck of the wine bottle, took an opener, and augured out the cork.
"He didn't have a crew?" "He preferred to single-hand. I watched him sail that day. Orange sky, orange water with a slow, heaving swell, had this weird feeling to it, like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. You study that in high school?"
I shook my head. "In high school, most of what I studied was cussin' and smokin' dope." He smiled.
"When you leave the Channel Islands, you sail out through a gap in the oil rigs. He turned and waved as he cast off. I watched until he left the harbor, and that's the last I ever saw of him."
His tone was hypnotic, mild envy mixed with mild regret. He poured the wine in a stemmed glass and passed it over to me.
"Did you know what he was doing?" "What was he doing? I guess I'm still not sure."
I said, "Apparently he was skipping." Eckert shrugged.
"I knew he was feeling desperate. I didn't think he meant to pull a fast one. At the time, especially when his last note to Dana came to light, I tried to accept the idea of his suicide. It didn't seem in character, but everybody else was convinced, so who was I to argue?"
He poured half a glass of wine for himself, set the bottle aside, and sat down on the banquette across from mine.
"Not everybody," I corrected.
The police didn't like it much, and neither did CF.
Will this make you a hero?
Only if we get the money back.
Doesn't seem very likely. Dana's probably got it all spent.
I didn't want to think about that.
How'd you feel about Wendell's death at the time?
Terrible, of course. Actually, I missed him, even with the flack I took. Strange thing is, he told me some of it. I didn't believe him, but he tried to let me know.
He told you he was leaving?
Well, he hinted as much. I mean, he never spelled it out. It was one of those statements you can interpret any way you want. He came to me, I think, in March, maybe 6 or 7 weeks before he sailed. Said, "Carl, buddy, I'm bailing. This whole fucking gig is coming down around our heads. I can't take it anymore. It's too much." Or words to that effect. I thought the guy was just blowing smoke. I knew we had big problems, but we'd been up against it before and we'd always come out okay. I figured this was just one more hairy episode in the Carl and Wendell show. Next thing I know, they find his boat drifting in the ocean. Looking back, you think, well, when he said bailing, did he mean he'd kill himself or cut out? But you were stuck either way, yes?
Yes, indeed. First thing they did was start checking back through the books. I guess I could have walked out the door then with just the clothes on my back, but I couldn't see the point. I had nowhere to go. I didn't have a cent, so I was forced to ride it out. Unfortunately, I had no idea the extent of what he'd done.
Was it actually fraud?
Oh, big time. It was major. The days went by and all this shit came to light. He'd been stripping the company till there was nothing left. In the letter he left, he claimed he'd been pouring every dime back in, but I didn't see any evidence to support the claim. What did I know? By the time I understood just how bad it was, there was no escape. I didn't even have a way to recoup my personal losses.
He paused and shrugged.
What can I say? With Wendell gone, there was just us chickens left. I gave him everything. I copped a plea and took the jail time just to get it over with. Now you tell me he's alive.
What a joke.
Are you bitter?
Of course.
He leaned his arm against the back of the banquette and rubbed his forehead idly.
I can understand his wanting out. At first I didn't realize the extent of his betrayal. I felt sorry for Dana and the kids, but I couldn't do anything about it if the guy was dead.
He shrugged and sent me a rueful smile, moving with sudden energy.
What the hell? It's over with and you have to move on.
That seems generous. He gestured carelessly. He glanced at his watch.
I'm going to have to call this a day. I have a breakfast meeting in the morning at 7 o'clock sharp. I need to get some sleep. Shall I walk you out?
I got up and set my empty wine glass aside. I can do it, I said. It's just a straight shot to the gate. I reached out and shook his hand. I appreciate your time. You'll probably hear from me again. Do you still have my card?
He pulled a corner of it from his shirt pocket to assure me it was there.
If Wendell gets in touch, could you let me know?
Absolutely, he said.
I eased my way up the galley stairs, ducking my head as I emerged on deck. Behind me, I was conscious of Eckert's continuing gaze, his smile bemused as he watched me depart. Weird, but in retrospect, Dana Jaffe's response had seemed the truer.
Chapter 9.
The walk back to my place took less than 10 minutes. I was still wide awake, braced by the sea air. Instead of opening the gate and going into the backyard, I turned and headed down the street to Rosie's Tavern, which was located half a block away. In the old days, Rosie's was perpetually deserted, cavernous and dimly lighted, no doubt under constant surveillance by the health police. I used to meet clients there because nobody ever bothered us. As a single woman, I could drop in any time it suited me without attracting the unwanted attentions of bounders and cads. Rosie might harass me, but nobody else would. Recently, the place has been discovered by sports nuts, and a variety of teams seem to use it as a hangout, especially on occasions when they've just won a trophy and feel the need for a parade. Rosie, who can otherwise be unbearably disagreeable, actually seems to enjoy all the testosterone and hysteria. In an unprecedented move, she's even taken to displaying their hardware on the shelf behind the bar, which now boasts a permanent exhibit of winged silver angels holding globes above their heads. Tonight, the bowling championship. Tomorrow, the free world. As usual, the place was jumping, and my favorite table in the rear was occupied by a gang of rowdies.
There was no sign of Rosie, but William was perched on a stool at the bar, surveying the premises with a look of sublime satisfaction. All the patrons seemed to know him, and there was much good-natured bantering going back and forth. Henry was seated at a table by himself, his head bent over a pad of paper where he was mapping out a crossword puzzle entitled, "I Spy with My Little Eye." He'd been working on this one for the better part of a week, using espionage novels and old television shows as the underlying theme. He publishes regularly in the little crossword puzzle books you see in grocery store lines. Aside from the fact that he picks up some extra money, he's actually known by name among crossword puzzle buffs. He was wearing chinos and a white T-shirt, his face creased with concentration. I took the liberty of pulling out an extra chair at his table, turning it around so that the back rested against the table. I straddled the chair and rested my arms along the top rail. Henry sent an irritated look in my direction, and then relaxed when he saw it was me.
"I thought you were one of them."
I looked around at the crowd. "Where'd we go wrong? A year ago there was never anybody in the place. Now it's a zoo. How's it going?"
"I need an 8-letter word that starts with I. It can end in anything, more or less."
A word flashed through my head, and I counted on my fingers. "Imposter," I said. He stared at me blankly, doing the mental arithmetic.
"Not bad. I'll take it.
How about 5 letters down?" "Stop right there," I said, cutting in. "You know I'm terrible at this stuff, and it just makes me tense. I scored once by a fluke. I think I'll retire while I'm ahead." He tossed his notepad on the table and placed his pencil behind his left ear.
"You're right. It's time to pack it in for the day. What are you having? I'll buy you a drink."
"Nothing for me. I'm about partied out, but I'll keep you company if you're having one."
"I'm fine for now. How'd you do with Dana Jaffe? Did you get any place?"
"I didn't expect to. I was just making her acquaintance. I also had a chat with Wendell's ex-partner."
"And what did he have to say?"
As I filled him in on my conversations with Dana Jaffe and Carl Eckert, I saw Henry's gaze stray toward the kitchen, and I found myself turning automatically.
"Well, would you look at that," I said.
William was emerging with a tray full of food, a not inconsiderable burden for a man of 86. As usual, he was decked out in a 3-piece suit with a properly starched white shirt and a crisply knotted tie. He looked enough like Henry to be his twin, though in reality the two men were 2 years apart. At the moment, William was looking very pleased with himself, high-spirited and energetic. It was the first time I'd registered the changes in him. 7 months before, when he'd moved in with Henry, he'd been morbidly self-obsessed, continually cross-referencing his various illnesses and infirmities. He'd brought his medical records with him when he arrived from the Midwest, and he was constantly assessing the state of his health. His heart palpitations, his digestive tract, his allergies, his suspicions about diseases undiscovered yet. A favorite pastime of his was cruising local funerals, where he commiserated with the other mourners to assure himself he wasn't dead yet. After he and Rosie fell in love, he'd begun to lighten up, until now he worked a full day side by side with her. Sensing that we were watching, he grinned happily. He set down the tray of food and began to unload plates. One of the patrons at the table made some remark to him. William crowed with delight and high-fived the guy on the spot.
"What's he so happy about?" "He asked Rosie to marry him."
I stared at Henry, startled.
"You're kidding.
He did? God, that's great! What a hoot! I can't believe it!"
"A hoot is not exactly how I'd refer to it. This just goes to show what happens when you live in sin."
"They've lived in sin for a week. Now he's making her an honest woman, whatever that means. I think it's sweet." I put a hand on Henry's arm, giving it a shake.
"You don't really mind, do you? I mean, way down deep?" "Let's put it this way. I'm not as appalled as I thought I'd be. I resigned myself to the possibility the day he moved in. He's too conventional a fellow to flaunt proprieties."
"So when's all this happening?"
"I have no idea. They haven't set the date. He just asked her tonight. She hasn't agreed to it yet."
"The way you were talking, I assumed she had."
"Well, no, but she's hardly going to turn down a gentleman of his caliber."
I gave his hand a smack. "Honestly, Henry, you're a bit of a snob." He smiled at me, blue-eyed, his brows lifting quizzically.
"I'm a complete snob, not a bit of one."
Come on, I'll walk you back.
Once home, I took a handful of medication for my assorted cold symptoms, including a hit of NyQuil that guaranteed a good night's sleep. At 6 o'clock, I rolled out of bed groggily and pulled on my jogging clothes, filling out a mental checklist while I brushed my teeth. My chest was still congested, but my nose wasn't running, and my cough no longer sounded like my lungs were on the verge of flopping out. My skin color had lightened to the mild gold of apricots, and I thought in another day or so might revert to my natural skin tone. Never have I so yearned for my former pale complexion. I bundled up against the early morning chill, my gray sweats nearly the same color as the ocean. The beach sand was a chalky white, speckled with foam from the outgoing tide. Seagulls, gray and white, stood and stared at the water like a flock of yard ornaments. The sky at the horizon was a perfect blend of cream and silver, the mist blocking out all but the darkened outlines of the islands in the channel. This was hurricane season in the far reaches of the Pacific, but so far we hadn't had a hint of tropical surf. The hush was profound, undercut only by the soft rustle of the waves. There was not another soul as far as I could see. The 3-mile walk became a meditation, just me and my labored breathing, the feel of my leg muscles responding to the brisk pace. By the time I reached home, I was ready to face the day. Through the front door, I caught the muffled sound of the telephone. I let myself into my apartment in haste. I caught it on the third ring, out of breath from the exertion. It was Mac.
"What's up? This is awfully early for you."
I buried my face in my T-shirt, suppressing a cough.
"We had a meeting last night. Gordon Titus has gotten wind of this Wendell Jaffe business and wants to meet with you."
"With me?" I squeaked. Mac laughed.
"He doesn't bite."
"He doesn't have to," I said. "Titus can't stand me, and the feeling is mutual. He treats me like a piece of..."
"No, no," he broke in.
I was going to say dirt.
"Well, that's better."
"Human out your butt type dirt," I amended.
"You better get yourself down here as soon as you can."
I sat for a moment making faces at the phone, my usual terribly mature method of dealing with the world. I did not exactly rush out the door as advised. I stripped off my sweatsuit and took a hot shower, washed my hair thoroughly, and then got dressed. I had a bite to eat while I scanned the paper for news of interest. I rinsed my dish and my spoon and then took out a small load of trash, which I dumped in the bin by the street. When I ran out of ways to avoid the inevitable, I grabbed my handbag, a steno pad, and my car keys and headed out the gate. This was making my stomach hurt. The office really hadn't changed much, though I noticed for the first time a certain shabbiness throughout. The wall-to-wall carpet was a quality synthetic, but the style had been chosen for its wearability, a term synonymous with mottled, stain-mimicking patterns guaranteed not to soil. The space itself seemed crowded by the warren of action stations, dozens of interlocking cubicles for examiners and underwriters. The perimeter was lined with glass-enclosed offices for the company executives. The walls needed fresh paint, and the trim was looking scuffed. Vera glanced up from her desk as I passed. From that angle, I was the only witness to her facial antics, eyes crossed, tongue protruding slightly in comical disgust. We met in Titus's office. I hadn't laid eyes on him since the day of our encounter. I had no idea what to expect, and I couldn't quite decide what behavior to adopt. He simplified the matter by greeting me pleasantly, as if this were our first meeting and we'd never exchanged a cross word. It was a brilliant move, really, because it freed me of any necessity to defend or apologize, relieving him of the burden of cross-referencing our past relationship. After the first 60 seconds, I found I had disconnected. I realized the man had no power over me at this point. Debts on both sides were paid, and both of us had ended up with exactly what we wanted. He'd removed what he'd seen as deadwood from the company payroll. I'd reestablished myself in a work environment I preferred. Meanwhile, in the present, Mac Voorhees and Gordon Titus were a perfect contrast to one another. Mac's brown suit was as wrinkled as an autumn leaf, while his teeth and the flip of puffy white hair in front were discolored by the staining properties of nicotine. Gordon Titus wore an ice-blue dress shirt with the sleeves rolled up. His gray pants were crisply pleated, the shade an eerie match for his prematurely gray hair. His tie formed a fierce punctuation mark, emphasizing his office manner, which was terse and businesslike. Even Mac knew enough not to light a cigarette in his presence. Titus sat down at his desk and opened the file in front of him. Typically, he'd outlined the relevant data about Dana and Wendell Jaffe. Neatly indented paragraphs marched sideways across the page, the paper pockmarked with holes where the nib of his pen had plunged through. He spoke without looking at me, his face as empty of expression as a mannequin's.
"Max brought me up to date, so we don't need to cover any old ground," he said. "What's the status of the case?"
I hold out my steno pad and flip to an empty page, reciting what I knew about Dana's current situation. I detailed as much as possible and then summarized the rest.
"She's probably used part of the insurance benefits to finance Michael's house, with another hefty chunk going as a retainer for Brian's attorney."
Titus was making notes.
"Have you talked to the company lawyers about our position in this?"
"What's the point?" Mac broke in. "So what if Wendell faked his own death? What crime did he commit? Is that against the law? What's it called, faking suicide?"
He snapped his fingers, trying to jog his memory. I said, "Suicide is the term I've heard."
"Suicide, right. Is it against the law to falsify your own death?" he asked.
"It is if you do it with intent to defraud the insurance company," Titus said with acid.
Mac's expression was impatient.
"Where's the fraud? What fraud? At this point, we don't know that he's collected a cent."
Titus's gaze up to Mac.
"You're absolutely right. To be precise about it, we're not even sure it's really Jaffe we're dealing with."
And then to me,
"I want concrete evidence, proof of identity, fingerprints, or some damn thing."
"I'm doing what I can," I said, sounding both dubious and defensive.
I made a note on a blank page, just to look industrious. The note said, "Find Wendell." Like I was unclear on the concept until Titus spelled it out.
"In the meantime, what? You want to go after Mrs. Jaffe?"
Again, Mac's exasperation surfaced. I couldn't figure out what he was so upset about.
"God damn it, what's she done? She hasn't committed a crime as far as we know. How can she be held liable for spending money she believes she's legally entitled to?"
"What makes you think she wasn't in on this from the beginning? For all we know, the two colluded," Titus said.
"To what end?" I interjected mildly. "For the last 5 years, the woman's been dead broke, accumulating debts by the bushel basket. Meanwhile, Wendell's down in Mexico by the pool with some babe. What kind of deal is that? Even if she collects, all she ends up with is money to pay off the bill collectors."
"You only have her word for that," Titus said. "Besides which, we don't really know how Mr. and Mrs. Jaffe accommodated their relationship. Maybe the marriage was over, and this was his way of negotiating spousal support."
"Some support," I said.
Titus plowed right over me.
"And as you yourself pointed out, it looks like she's managed to buy one kid a house and probably retain the services of a hotshot attorney for the one who's in trouble. The bottom line is, we need to have a conversation with Wendell Jaffe. Now, how do you propose to find him?"
The question was abrupt, but the tone was more curious than challenging.
"I figure Brian's the perfect bait, and if Wendell's too paranoid to approach him in jail, he can always contact Dana. Or Michael, his oldest, who has a child Wendell's never seen. Even his ex-partner Carl is a possibility."
It all sounded weak, but what was I going to do?
"Fake it, that's what."
Max stirred.
"You can't run a 24-hour surveillance on the whole lot of them. Even if we hire other ops on this, you're talking thousands of dollars going out, and in return for what?"
"True enough," I said. "Do you have a suggestion?"
Mac crossed his arms, turning his attention back to Titus.
"Whatever we do, we better get a move on," he said. "My wife could go through a 500,000 clams in a week."
Titus stood up and closed his file with a snap.
"I'll call the company attorney and see if he can get us a temporary restraining order. With a TRO, we can get a lock on Mrs. Jaffe's bank accounts and prevent any more monies going out."
"She's going to love that," I said. "Is there anything specific you want her to do in the meantime, Gordon?"
Titus sent me a chilly smile.
"I'm sure she'll think of something."
He looked at his watch as a signal that we were dismissed. Mac went into his office, which was two doors down. There was no sign of Vera. I chatted briefly with Darcy Pascoe, the CF receptionist, and then I went back to Lonnie's office, where I took care of odds and ends. I picked up messages, opened mail, sat on my swivel chair, and swiveled for a while, hoping for inspiration about where I should go next. In the absence of a great idea, I tried the only other action item that occurred to me. I put in a call to Lieutenant Whiteside at the police department, asking him if I could have the telephone number of Lieutenant Harris Brown, who'd worked on the case when Wendell first disappeared. Jonah Robb had told me Brown had since retired, but he might have information. "Do you think he'd be willing to talk to me?" I asked. "I have no idea, but I'll tell you what," he said. "His telephone's unlisted, and I wouldn't want to give it to you unless I had his okay. When I can find a minute, I'll give him a call. If he's interested, I'll have him get in touch with you."
"Great, that'd be fine. I'd appreciate the contact."
I hung up the phone and made a note to myself. If I didn't hear in 2 days, I'd try calling back. I wasn't sure the man would be any help, but you never knew. Some of those old cops loved nothing better than to reminisce. He might have suggestions about places Wendell might be holding up. In the meantime, what? I went back to the Xerox machine and ran off several dozen copies of the flyer with Wendell's photograph. I'd added my name and telephone number in a box at the bottom, indicating my interest in the man's whereabouts. I filled my gas tank and hit the road again, heading back to Perdido. I cruised past Dana's house, did a U-turn at the intersection, and pulled into a parking place across the street. I began a door-to-door canvass, moving patiently from house to house. I worked my way down the block, leaving a flyer in the screen door if there was no one home. On Dana's side of the street, many couples apparently worked, because the houses were dark and there were no cars in the drive. When I found someone home, the conversations all seemed to share the same boring elements. "Hello," I would say quickly, trying to work in my message before I could be mistaken for a salesperson. "I wonder if you might give me some help. I'm a private investigator working to locate a man we think might be in the area. Have you seen him recently?" I would hold up the artist's composite of Wendell Jaffe, waiting without much hope while the person's gaze moved across his features. Much mental scratching of chins. "No, no, I don't think so. No, ma'am. What was it the man did? I hope you're not telling me he's dangerous." "Actually, he's wanted for questioning in a fraud investigation." Hand cupped behind the ear. "What's that?" I would raise my voice. "Do you remember a couple of estate developers a few years back? They had a company called CSL Investments, and they put together syndicates." "Oh, my Lord, yes. Well, of course I remember them. The one fellow killed himself, and the other one went to jail." On and on it went, with no one contributing any fresh information. Across the street from Dana, and about 6 doors down, I had better luck. I knocked on the door of a house identical to hers, same model, same exterior, dark gray with white trim. The man who answered was in his early 60s, wearing shorts, a flannel shirt, dark socks, and an incongruous pair of wingtips. His gray hair was all a bristle, and he wore a pair of half-glasses at the midpoint on his septum, peering at me blue-eyed above the smudged surface of his lenses. A mask of white whiskers covered the lower part of his face, a possible refusal to shave more than twice a week. He was narrow through the shoulders, and his posture seemed stooped, a curious combination of elegance and defeat. Maybe the hard-soled shoes were a holdover from his former occupation. I was guessing salesman, or a stockbroker, someone who spent his life in a 3-piece suit. "What can I do for you?" he said, the question intended more for efficiency than any real assistance. "I wonder if you could help me. Are you acquainted with Mrs. Jaffe from across the street?"
"The one whose boy's been screwing up? We know the family," he said cautiously. "What's he done now? Or what hasn't he done might be the better question in this case."
"This is actually about his father." There was a silence.
"I thought he was dead."
"That's what everybody thought until recently. Now we have reason to believe he's alive and possibly returning to California. This is an updated likeness along with my business number. I'd appreciate a call if you should spot him in the area." I held the flyer out, and he took it.
"Well, I'll be damned. It's always something with that bunch," he said.
I watched his gaze trace a triangle from the photograph of Wendell to Dana's house down the street, and then back to my face.
"This is probably none of my business, but what's your connection to the Jaffes? Are you a relative?"
"I'm a private investigator working for the company that wrote the policy on Wendell Jaffe's life."
"Is that right?" he said.
He cocked his head.
"Why don't you come on in a second? I wouldn't mind hearing this."
Chapter 10. I hesitated for just a second, and a smile creased his face.
Don't worry about it. I'm not the boogeyman. My wife's on the premises pulling weeds in the garden. Both of us work at home in one capacity or another. If anybody's going to spot Mr. Jaffe, it's most likely us. What's your name again?
He backed into the hallway, motioning for me to follow. I moved across the threshold behind him.
Kinsey Milhone. Sorry, I should have introduced myself. That's my name there at the bottom of the flyer.
I held out my hand and we shook.
Good to meet you. Don't worry about it. Jerry Irwin. My wife's name is Lena. She saw you bumping doors across the street. I got a study in the back. She can bring us coffee if you like.
None for me, thanks.
She's going to love this, he said. Lena! Hey, Lena!
We reached his study, a small room paneled in a light veneer, scored and pockmarked to look like knotty pine. An L-shaped desk occupied most of the space, the walls lined with floor-to-ceiling metal shelves.
Let me see if I can find her. Have a seat, he said.
He headed off down the hall, moving toward the back door. I sat down on a metal folding chair and did a quick check of my surroundings, trying to get a feel for Irwin in his absence. Computer, monitor, and keyboard. Lots of floppy disks neatly filed. Open banker's boxes filled with some kind of color illustrations, segregated by sheets of cardboard. A low metal bookshelf to the right of the desk held numerous heavy volumes with titles I couldn't read. I leaned closer, squinting. Burke's General Armory. Armorial General Rietstop. New Dictionary of American Family Names. Dictionary of Surnames. Dictionary of Heraldry. I could hear him hollering out into the backyard, and moments later the sound of conversation as the two moved toward the study where I was waiting. I sat back in the chair, trying to look like a woman unconsumed by nosiness. I stood up as they entered, but Mrs. Irwin shooed me onto my seat again. Her husband tossed the flyer on his desk and moved around to his chair. Lena Irwin was petite and on the plump side for her height, dressed for gardening in Japanese farmer's pants and a blue chambray shirt with the sleeves rolled up. She'd pinned up her gray hair, damp tendrils escaping from various combs and barrettes. The spattering of freckles across her broad cheekbones suggested that her hair might have been red once upon a time. Her prescription